This is a conversation with Vincent Wong, an attorney and a member of the Lao San Collective, on Hong Kong, abolition, and the potential future of global authoritarian capitalism. Vincent and Lao San have been tireless in their chronicling and analysis of the Hong Kong protests, both how there have been conservative, liberal, and leftist tendencies all mixed into the movement, along with what the Hong Kong protests have to say in terms of advice, strategy, and warning for the rest of the world and protesters who look to challenge the state, capital, or the racism that makes up many of our societies. It's a fascinating conversation with a mind who's able to break down many different issues and aspects of the Hong Kong protests, as well as connect them to conversations globally, in particular the framework of abolition, which both Vincent and I think holds great promise for a global left that too often is balkanized by labels of Marxism, communism, socialism, or anarchism. Perhaps the framework of all cops are bad, all prisons are bad, can be the one that leads us to global liberation and a better, more just world. For more conversations like this, you can go to our back catalog. We're on Apple, Spotify, and other podcast platforms. And you can go to our website, asiaarttours.com. We host print interviews, articles, and collaborations with artists, thinkers, and organizers from around the world. All right, here's our conversation with Vincent Wong of Lao San. I hope you enjoy.
So my name is Vincent Wong. I'm a member of the Lao San Collective, which is a Hong Kong decolonial leftist collective of writers, artists, and researchers, activists. And I'm also a human rights lawyer based in Toronto. And I'm happy to be here on this podcast today.
Could you talk about what has recently happened in Hong Kong in regards to this national security law? We don't need to talk about the law in terms of its legal structure. I think increasingly we're entering or re-entering like sort of Bush era, where these aren't really laws. These are just sort of ways to do things. You don't want to follow, quote unquote, the rule of law. You just want to get shit done. So you describe this, I think, as importing China's legal system into Hong Kong. That was its main sort of function. But why has it, if you look on Twitter or social media, why has it alarmed so many people after, you know, seemingly a year or more than a year of just absolutely really standing up to police and situations like we're seeing in Portland, Oregon, people getting disappeared, not really knowing what's happening? Why was this sort of the most feared tool that seems to, for now, have stopped the mass protests that we saw earlier?
So I think your initial read of it is correct in that the details of the law matter, but it doesn't matter. That's not the primary issue, although the details are pretty horrible. And the primary issue is that behind the scenes, the Xi administration has pretty much had it with Hong Kong, right? So this is the poison pill in that not only are we going to draft this law for you and bypass all sort of legislative and governmental Hong Kong oversight, but we're actually going to help enforce it for you, which is with the establishment of the National Security Office in Hong Kong that is run by the Chinese government, and agents of the National Security Office are not bound by Hong Kong's legal jurisdiction. There are many kind of things going on, but all of these things erode essentially to nothingness the principle of Hong Kong's autonomy under one country, two systems, and the foundation of of its, if its constitutional structure. So it, it basically what that means is like Hong Kong as we know it will be gone after this. So that's kind of been the impact. I'll flag a couple of things that I think maybe audiences ought to know. One is on penalties. The penalties for these offenses are all pretty intense. So you're talking about in regular cases, minimum 3 years in jail, more serious cases, you know, up to 10 years. Regular cases up to 10 years and more serious cases up to life imprisonment, and for all of them. So for succession, subversion, terrorism, and collusion with foreign forces. So we've talked about the enforcement. Also on oversight, trials are closed, right? For reasons such as maintaining state secrets and public order, right? So it's very hard if decided by the chief executive that this trial is going to be closed for national security reasons. Nobody can figure out what the hell is going on. It provides all sorts of overrides for local Hong Kong law to instead use Chinese procedural law if there are inconsistencies. And it allows for extradition, essentially, for certain cases, complex cases or particularly important cases that is built in that will essentially jettison an accused away from the Hong Kong legal system and directly under the prosecution of mainland authorities and under the jurisdiction, it will actually be tried in mainland courts. So all of these things come together to create an enormous kind of massive impact, which is already kind of showing itself within Hong Kong and abroad. And we can talk about those impacts further if you like. Maybe I'll just stop there but that's the summary of what's kind of going on.
We were talking before about Kong Sun Gan, who I've interviewed, and I generally like the level of detail he puts into sort of his coverage of the court system, the legal system, and like the psychology and makeup of the police. It's all cops are bastards. That's our position. But to sort of think through the psychology and the sort of conditioning that goes into making the cops who aren't already bastards become bastards is quite interesting. But when it comes to law, he made this point that in Hong Kong, you know, he's like, look, I've been a sort of an academic, a journalist many years, never met a judge, ever. And he was alluding to the fact that this was a very elite, sort of secretive group within Hong Kong who took themselves with utter self-seriousness and probably bordering, this is my editorializing, but seemingly bordering on sort of the point of that they saw themselves as above the fray, so to speak, that they were these ultimate arbiters of truth. Your article, where I believe it was for Lao San, but it's been reprinted elsewhere, sort of talks about how this national security law ports in the Chinese legal system to Hong Kong. And I'm wondering if you could talk about, from your knowledge of people who are judges or who were the hands of carcerality. So judges, police, prosecutors, will they be able to adjust to this law? Are they secretly or privately, you know, sort of fuming at just sort of that this is now being dictated to them? Or was Hong Kong's legal system already and its increasing carcerality, both through judges increasingly siding against protesters or being very punitive, police violence, was it already creeping towards this result and it was just sped up?
Yeah, so I'll make a preliminary comment on the idea about judges, and then we'll talk a little bit about like the arms of the carceral structure, kind of pre and post national security law. So the comment about judges in Hong Kong seeing themselves as, well, first of all, having an incredibly elite, well-off sort of class character and seeing themselves as arbiters of justice who are above the fray, that is, you know, if I may, like, the situation for judges pretty much everywhere. It certainly is the situation for judges in US and Canada. And that's just the way it is. I mean, if you could think about almost all qualifications to even become a lawyer, most of them in all jurisdictions have sort of this good character or honest character sort of requirement that is code for essentially excluding folks who have been part of the criminal justice system or have gone through immigration detention because of the stigma of criminalization and the logic that anybody who has this kind of stigma of criminalization could never be a lawyer, much less then be a judge, right? So then all of these folks have no real connection to going through the criminal system, right? That they actually control and dictate. So I would say that this is not specific to Hong Kong. This is how almost all legal systems and carceral systems work everywhere in the world, although there may be places where it's more intense and places that are less severe. So I will also say about the carceral systems, and what I mean by that is sort of like the investigators, the police, and then the prosecutors, and then judges, and afterwards the correctional system, like that whole kind of like prison pipeline. And yeah, I mean, there's no doubt that even beforehand, this entire system and the police as the vanguard of that system was committed to protecting the political and economic status quo, and specifically the elites of Hong Kong, right? That has always been true. There had been some level under like a more liberalish system of counterbalance to that, where kind of elites are expected to keep elites in check. That goes through kind of, you know, constitutional protections. It goes through criminal procedural protections, and those aren't nothing, right? Like you can say that they don't go as far as necessary. The system itself is kind of broken and completely slanted towards those with resources and power, which is probably true. But there was still some of that counterbalance. With this national security law, all those counterbalances will be gone. And you can just take a look at, you know, one example of it is the new powers that will be created just for Hong Kong police under the national security law. Almost unlimited search powers, restricting overseas travel, freezing and confiscation of property, requiring service providers to delete information and requiring them to generate data. Secret surveillance and interception of telecommunications without warrant. All of these things are now possible under invoking certain provisions of the national security law. If you are, let's say, somebody in the Hong Kong police who is of a very law and order, whatever it takes, get the bad guys, you love this because it gives you power beyond what was given before, and the oversight is much less. And in any ways, you know, the Hong Kong Police Force had been very closely working with their mainland counterparts anyway, right? So I think for most people that currently are still within the Hong Kong Police Force, a lot of them will be pretty happy that this is happening. With judges, it's probably a little different. Because, well, if you're willing to toe the line, it may be okay. But if you really, really take yourself seriously about ideas of rule of law, or you really believe in sort of kind of the British style common law system, you believe in judicial independence and checks and balances, this is really, really tough. It's going to be a tough pill to swallow for a lot of these judges. But if they want to kind of keep their job, they will feel a lot of pressure to toe the line as well.
How, through some of the language or what we see with policing globally, where it seems often designed to reproduce the violences of racism and reproduce sort of race or caste or class to manage that in a blunt way when for the areas the state cannot. How did that work, if at all, in Hong Kong? In what ways could we apply sort of an abolitionist lens where if we got rid of the Hong Kong police, that certain divisions that might seem invisible in a majority ethnically Chinese society, that there were under the surface quite a bit of divisions or casting or social reproduction that through an abolitionist lens become visible?
Maybe I'll start by saying that my reading of most abolitionist literature is that you don't start with the idea of just taking away the police and see what would happen, right? It would be much more of a process, and it'd be much more of a generative process as much as it is divesting money away from police. Because usually the way politically that we've seen kind of abolitionists go is the short-term or medium-term goals are projects to divest in prisons, in policing, and reinvest in the institutions that will bring about, you know, if I may kind of paraphrase the Angela Davis portion of it, is bring about the conditions by which, you know, crime will be greatly lessened, or the need to engage in most crimes, which are usually against property because of very kind of unequal economic and life necessity sharing. To address those issues by which crime stem from, right? And so getting to that place will require a lot of time and a lot of reinvention of what we think is possible with our political and economic systems. It may require a wholesale kind of democratization of our economic organizations, right? Like a much more flat horizontal worker cooperatives, you know, what have you. So it wouldn't really be about taking away the police, and then there will be an enormous kind of power vacuum, of course, and then whoever is the strongest in society then will take the reins and reproduce a lot of the same oppressions, right? Like, I think most abolitionist literature is pretty open-eyed about that. And so I think abolitionists, or people that want to take abolitionism seriously in Hong Kong, probably should consider that too. I mean, there's going to be a long period of sort of prefigurative politics that you're kind of getting a lot of these social functions away from the state. And there's another portion of it, which is getting justice and community accountability processes away from a criminal prosecutorial stranglehold, right? What does harm prevention, what does harm intervention, what does harm accountability look like in a community setting outside of the control of professionalized justice elites, like law enforcement officers, like lawyers, like judges, right? And that is going to be a big work in progress. Final thing I'll add to this is to respond to your point about racism and class hierarchy in Hong Kong and the extent to which the movement hasn't, let's say, sufficiently foregrounded those things. That's a proper criticism. And that's a strategic, I would even say that's kind of a strategic decision that was made early on in 2019, right? That this time around, you know, kind of feeding from the failure of the umbrella movement and Occupy Central in 2014, activists realized that in order to achieve the critical mass that was necessary in Hong Kong to resist further erosion of the one country, two principles system, they needed to essentially band together in a big tent sort of way. This has increased the strength of the resistance. This has conservatized the politics of the resistance. And that's why you see the core of the movement rally around things that everybody can agree on. That is essentially an anti-authoritarian movement, broadly speaking, right? If you think about the five core demands, they're demands about universal suffrage, right? Greater democratization. They're demands about civilian oversight, like more strong civilian oversight over police actions. And their demands around freeing political prisoners, right? So those are sort of broad anti-authoritarian issues. They're not anti-capitalist demands, right? They're not anti-racist demands, but those were the things that were broad enough that could bring people together from lots of different kind of political positionalities. And then when you think about the political left in Hong Kong, they agree with those things too, right? Those kind of anti-authoritarian demands, but they also, support much greater socioeconomic equity, right? And redistributive politics. They also support sex worker politics. They also support anti-racism and anti-xenophobia. They support queer politics. So there's this kind of additional basket that is not represented in the social movement more broadly. And then that creates problems later on when you're trying to speak to other social movements that are perhaps much more politically radical, if you could say.
And through dialoguing with abolitionists, how have you come to see that as a useful heuristic? We already mentioned all cops are bad being a very, for me, a very useful heuristic of who I can build solidarity with. We'd like to abolish prisons. Those are very useful heuristics that, while broad and allowing for multiple steps or non-reformist reforms, as Ruth Wilson Gilmore calls them, in the pursuit of those goals, it allows for me a relatively big tent where it seems the language of a lot of leftists, David Harvey, Nick Estes, predominantly come to mind, as well as others, seem Vijay Prashad as well, and too many white leftists to name, but Jacobin, obviously, are very caught up, despite the good work of people like Lao San, Eli Friedman, Darren Byler, of saying, look, these past labels of leftism no longer apply. Communist, Marxist, that reality isn't one that's very useful. Maybe in the future it will be, but none of that really remains in terms of the revolutionary energy of the 60s. Do you have a sense for trying to build solidarity? And I'm sure having many infuriating encounters, or encounters, if we want to be more hopeful, that these other ideologies are causing blockages. Have you seen abolition as a very useful tool for Hong Kong, both now and perhaps in the future, in terms of building solidarity?
Yeah, this is a really good question. I think it's applicable to a lot of different contexts right now, which is why I really like the question. I do see, and I think a lot of people around the world are starting to really see abolitionism, primarily prison abolitionism, because that's what most people can more easily get around, but also police abolitionism as being a useful heuristic for global solidarity among activists. And I'll point to rather than going into depth as to why I think so, I'll point to a very specific project that Lao San is actually a part of and a co-founding member of, which is the Global Prison Abolition Coalition. If you want to check it out for audiences, it's worldwithoutprisons.org, I believe. And it more kind of it tries to do several things. I think the most important things, from my specific point of view, that they do is put together in conversation a lot of different contexts, across five continents, right? Of places where there are prison abolitionists, there are police abolitionists, and they're having very specific type of struggles, and explaining those struggles to other folks that are doing similar work but in different contexts, and then drawing out those parallels, drawing out differences, and drawing out points of solidarity. But really, it's not difficult, right? Like, when you have folks that are really committed to kind of prisoner support and, the taking down of the very, very large footprint of the prison industrial complex in, let's say, Turkey, and then have them talk to folks in Bolivia, and then you have them talk to folks in Canada, they 30 seconds in, they'll immediately spot, you don't have to do a lot of work. They'll immediately spot the parallels that are happening if they're in the same kind of conversation, right? So that is a really, really important thing. And then a broader move, which is, I think, the revolutionary potential in projects like this, is starting to center abolitionist politics as a core tenet of international leftism, right? Similar to the transnational kind of political intervention that climate change brought about with the energy that has coalesced around, massive kind of economic reforms that are much more ecologically and society, from a society angle, sustainable and equitable, like a kind of a new Green Deal in many sort of different contexts. This abolitionist framing as a core tenet of international leftism is something that I think people are more and more having the appetite for. And you can see it during COVID, how much Black liberation abolitionist literature and praxis has been studied around the world, right? And we're not just talking about Hong Kong, we're talking about Middle East, we're talking about Latin America, we're talking about Europe, we're talking about South Asia, lots of different places. And so this is really, going back to the infuriating kind of discussions, like that sometimes you would have with leftists. I think here is where you get a very clear picture of who is with us and who is not with us, right? If you are an authoritarian leftist who really strongly believes in using carceral tools, mass incarceration, secret police, you don't believe in the idea of kind of, you believe in the idea that you must have an extensive network of surveillance and incarceration for control for your political purposes, then it's clear that you will not be part of a global abolitionist sort of coalition, right? if you are somebody who sees the world as sort of this kind of characterized risk board, in which as long as the states that you support and that you like will have hegemony and control over kind of imperialist mechanisms of power and control, and they're the ones with control over the carceral system, then you're not going to be okay with our politics, right? So it creates this very this moment of kind of reckoning in international leftism. You can talk about it in terms of, you know, like Marxist-Leninists or anarchists or Trotskyists or Stalinists, and you know, there are useful kind of lines to draw there. But I really think that portion has an enormous kind of potential to build upon and break through the ideas of the kind of rigid ideas of communist capitalism, democracy, freedom, heuristics that are becoming less and less able to properly articulate what we're seeing in the early 21st century.
In Minneapolis, Portland, New York City, we've seen mutual aid being explicitly targeted. So I don't know how closely you followed the Portland protests. There's these like food stalls. One of them is called Riot Ribs, named sort of cheekily. I'll just use this as an example. I'm sure there's great indigenous examples, but I'm not as familiar with the indigenous movements of Canada. So if in reply one comes to mind, feel free to use that. Why do you think in this time of sort of global neoliberalism would mutual aid as a tactic be so threatening to the state? So Hong Kong, when I went to see the protests for myself and march in solidarity, there were all these mutual aid stands. You need water, here's some water. You need a mask, here's a mask. You need food, here's some food. In all these protests globally, we see mutual aid. These are nonviolent methodologies. There's nothing confrontational about giving anyone a sandwich, as far as I know. Why do you think in a time of global neoliberalism, we consistently see these places targeted? And for you, does mutual aid represent sort of a threat to the there is no alternative reality of neoliberalism we live in currently?
Yeah, this is a really good question. I'm going to try to answer it in a different way with a different framework, and we'll see how this goes. I actually haven't written this down before, but I think the way you phrased your question made me think of this. So I think most governments in the world, especially those that are increasingly becoming authoritarian capitalists, you know, whether they, it may be like an authoritarian capitalist government with like democratic characteristics, right? Like kind of where the Trump America is going. But they are increasingly using what in some literature is called counterinsurgency as a mode of ordinary governance, right? You think about counterinsurgency theory as something that came out in the 50s and 60s, but has really been sort of perfected post 9/11 by the US military in Afghanistan and in Iraq, which sees any sort of polity as having three parts, right? You have these folks who will kind of like pro-establishment folks who are pretty vested in you know, whatever the ruling ideology is, whether it's ideology or invested by virtue of economic interest, right? So they're the folks that you don't have to convince and will support you if you're the governing structure. You have folks who, no matter what, whether they're the ones that are economically or racially or, you know, whatever societally marginalized, or directly exploited and targeted, as many workers are. They're the ones that are politicized and will oppose you no matter what. And they're the dangerous ones, right? They may oppose you militarily, right? Or militantly, sorry. And then you have this huge squishy middle. The middle is by far the largest group. Governments now are essentially dealing with their own polities like this. This was what was applied to places like Iraq, right, in Afghanistan. And then the counterinsurgency part of it was really to get all information possible on everyone, launch an enormous propaganda campaign to get the people in the mushy middle on your side as much as possible, and then sort of eliminate the resistance portion of it by any means necessary, right? And why am I, you know, kind of going through all this kind of a theoretical background? Because here's where we can understand why mutual aid is so threatened, right? So you mentioned, Matt, you know, you got folks giving people water. You got folks giving people sandwiches and like granola bars and stuff, right? You got maybe some folks giving out masks, or, you know, if it's a pretty long occupation, you know, helping folks with homework or like childcare, stuff like this. This is dangerous because it is the resourcing by which political resistance to your control, these are the supply lines, right? These are supply lines, these are logistical lines. And by doing this, it further consolidates the power of folks who are resisting your systems, right? Your economic and political systems. And so this is my hypothesis. People in governance, if you are from this line of thinking, which people I've observed are more implicitly open to now, especially if you're a police state, see this as war. And these mutual aid tactics that are outside the state, right, as literally the same as logistical supply lines and food provision and services for a enemy combatant force. And so if you think in that term, you must destroy these mutual aid tactics, these mutual aid structures immediately, right? They become now as important a target as the people that are actually the frontline activists and the big, you know, kind of movers and shakers. So I would say that is one of the reasons why, in my reading of the situation, mutual aid infrastructures are being targeted and will be increasingly targeted by governments as protests will, I think, inevitably grow and pop up after COVID, and the devastation it's wrought really surfaces for people around the world.
And within that vein, one of the more moving and interesting things, obviously, being an American, where we are, my family is Armenian and Lebanese, so diasporic concerns, exodus, large organized state violence is part of our history. At the same time, how Arab Americans, many Arab Americans who could pass, became integrated into the United States was through integrating themselves into whiteness. Oftentimes, if you go back far enough, just like Angela Davis has done in her work, along with other abolitionists, you can actually see like laws about where the courts would argue, are Armenians white? And if you're into gallows humor, they're quite funny. They're very fucked up and weird. But for me, in following Hong Kong, sort of these ordinary people, you can just, there's media saturation up until now anyways, very high, along with the quality of journalism. You'll see like a van driving out of a prison or jail, dozens of people waiting for the arraigned, or waiting outside the police station for the arrested. You'll see, I think it's called Right With You or Right With Me campaigns, where at gatherings, they will organize these pop-up stands. They say, okay, you can write to the incarcerated or write to those people facing trial. And it's extremely powerful, particularly as the state and capital have tried to always make the criminal and the villain one and the same. How has, watching these protests, how have you seen that propaganda be defeated or in the process of being defeated by these mutual aid networks? How does protest or abolition or just what you've seen in Hong Kong remove so much of these stigmas that the state and capital try to foist upon us in terms of how they want us to see criminality?
I'll qualify this by saying again that the political imagination of resistance in Hong Kong has been shaped by its history and its constant, consistent history as the interface of global capital, as its raison d'etre for its entire period of time, right? So it literally, the only reason for its existence has been to be a big facilitator for global trade initially and global capital and high finance a little bit later on. So I see, because of the nature of which everything in Hong Kong depends on the functioning of global capital, and it always pretty much has been, people have a hard time, you know, it seems like too pie in the sky and not practical to think about completely other ways in which we could do things economically, right? It's just very difficult. So I would just qualify that when we're talking about what the effects are of the state and capital in criminalizing folks. Okay, so let's get to your question. About the stigma of incarceration and how mutual aid has kind of pushed back against that. I think it has done so strongly in certain ways and not in certain ways. So the divide where I see it as is political versus socioeconomic prisoners, right? They're both kind of captured by the state. They're both kind of criminalized, surveilled, harassed, incarcerated. But the stigma has only been really removed for the former, for the political prisoners. There's still lots of work to do on the latter, which are the socioeconomic prisoners, like people who are criminalized essentially because they are poor, or they are racialized, or they are migrants, or they are using drugs, or they are sex workers. And I think a great piece on this, however, like the potential for this is kind of JP's piece early in Popula, that, you know, basically, can we imagine a world without police in Hong Kong? And, you know, kind of JP talks about how Hong Kong protesters really have long known, even before these protests, that the concept of criminality is very conveniently malleable, right? Talking about the 1966 sort of use of riots to talk about working class folks who were protesting a ferry fare increase, right? And then now kind of really Kafkaesque and absurd uses of criminality, pretty strong criminality for, let's say, a student who's carrying a bunch of laser pointers in their bag. And so criminality as a social construct as a way to criminalize and repress dissent is very well understood in Hong Kong. Where it lacks the same kind of critique and resistance to stigma is how that is socialized. If criminality is a social construct, and the laws are essentially created to criminalize folks who are at the margins, right? And that is one of the limitations of having essentially a very well-educated, you can say, middle-class dominant sort of movement, right? To get that political realization, that political education takes a lot of work. And leftists in Hong Kong, unfortunately, have been doing great work, but they've been kind of shut out, or I'd say maligned as this term, kind of, you might have encountered it, left plastic, yeah. Which is basically saying you're on your moral high horse, but you really have no practical alternative to what we're doing, right? And that is a dangerous thing, because then you take away, you're cutting off the leg that will, I think, get Hong Kong from a place of disband the Hong Kong police, which has been pretty much like almost like a month after the protests started in earnest in June. That had been a very common call of disband the Hong Kong police. But what do they mean by disband the Hong Kong police? They mean just like firing a bunch of folks, reconstituting the police as like, quote unquote, a better police, right? That's the, if you don't have the socioeconomic and the social construct analysis of criminality, that's what is, I think, blocking the political imagination of the movement from getting to an explicitly abolitionist politics. And so if Hong Kong can start, not Hong Kong, I mean, if enough folks can start seeing the connections between socioeconomic and racialized sort of hierarchy and criminality that has been such a big part of abolitionist politics elsewhere in the world, then that gets them to a place, I think, where the stigma is really removed from social prisoners and a more robust critique of capitalism and its extremely kind of exploitative forms in Hong Kong can be reconciled.
What's very interesting is contrasting Hong Kong to things like JSEC and the little understood in Western left circles that Hong Kong for a very long time sort of acted as a hub. If you were a China-based activist, you could go into Hong Kong and communicate with other leftists and sort of, it would be semi-safe, increasingly less so, obviously. But this question of sort of global authoritarianism, recently it came out, the U.S. has been training police in Hong Kong, coupled with China moving sort of its own police force, quasi-police force, militant police force, increasingly having a presence in Hong Kong. I'm wondering for sort of what is to be done to, when we look at the state of sort of global movement. So for me, you know, I've given up on sort of there being a way to reform our way out of this. Reading Jane Mayer, studying the Hong Kong protests, looking at abolitionists and their work, like I think our only two options are general strike or riots. I don't think there's a legal way out of this. But Hong Kong offers us a really valuable connection to activists and thinkers who've, as you've said, have been at the forefront of sort of global capital. Wilfred Chan famously called Hong Kong a big-ass dongle for connecting Chinese capital to the global financial or global infrastructures of capital. That was very helpful for me to think through what it is, because I hear big ass and I go, oh, okay, that's kind of funny. And then I, dongle's a funny word. But I'm wondering, sort of as maybe a last question, I might have one follow-up, I don't think so. When you look at things like JSIC, JSIC failed, I'll link to it. I'm not going to get into what it was. When you look at Hong Kong's movement, there were strikes that were tried, but I'm not sure the sustainability of a general strike. But as an intersection of sort of global capital and authoritarianism, what does Hong Kong say to you about what options are left? Is it just riots or a general strike? Are you a bit more optimistic that we can cobble together some sort of legal coalition of states who would stand against Xinjiang or Hong Kong or Syria or Kashmir? What are your thoughts in terms of methodology for the people who are out in the streets now, having sort of seen the lengths that capital and the state will go to crush dissent?
As a general proposition, I think the people that are living through the specific consequences, political, economic, social, know their trade-offs the best. And I think it's helpful for diaspora because you're able to kind of step back and see this from afar to offer maybe some sort of broader and bigger ways of seeing it, because you have that sometimes distance is an asset, right? But there's of course limitations to that. How should I apply this? Okay, let's maybe talk about what, if I understood your question correctly, so Hong Kong has always been the dongle, okay, right? So the interface to between China and the rest of the world, mainly normally, the most is Western capital to access sort of the funds needed to attract foreign funds and vice versa, right? And it has been they use the metaphor the golden goose of China ever since it was brought back after handover in 97. And at that time, the size of Hong Kong's economy relative to mainland China was like 18-19%, right? An enormous amount. And now it's about less than 3% of mainland China's GDP, although it's still has a much more outsized importance because it's kind of FX, equity, debt markets are still an enormous part of the way that China attracts foreign direct investment, right? And how Chinese companies use that money to raise foreign funds and expand internationally. So it still has an important role to play. And where I would go differently than a lot of, I think, Hong Kong observers is that it can still play this role. You could crack down massively on Hong Kong's sort of freedoms and turn it into essentially a police state, which it's obviously doing now, and still be the dongle, right? The national security law, and I understand that this is not a particularly common opinion, but this is what I think. The national security law won't really affect capital flows to Hong Kong and through Hong Kong as much as you may think. Global capitalism can flourish easily under an authoritarian capitalist society. And Singapore is often kind of used as an example of this, right? You can have a very stable economic environment, investment environment, have courts that protect private property and contract rights and capital interests in a stable way in an authoritarian society. And sometimes it works even better than in a democratic society, right? So if the idea is, let's, you know, if I burn, you burn with me, right? Like that, which has essentially been the rallying call post national security law in Hong Kong. I honestly don't see Hong Kong's kind of global markets recovering, right? At some point. And the other thing that's going on is that you're seeing more relaxed capital controls in China, right, over many years, and a greater sophistication in finance, banking, security, and capital markets that moves away from Hong Kong as the big ass dongle. This is not a coincidence, right? In January 2020, right, this year, China basically said that we're going to lax financial regulation a lot. We're going to allow foreign banks to apply for their own onshore security businesses inside the mainland. So we're going to basically allow foreign banks and foreign investment banks to directly do business in China, right? And so when you see this, I read this as a direct move in response to what's happening in Hong Kong, right? If Hong Kong is going to be at risk politically, then we need to start diversifying to different other financial hubs in China. And the idea that China can't develop its own financial capital and services infrastructure without Hong Kong, at least in the, you know, in the long term, is absurd, right? There's just too much money to be made. There's too much business to be had, right? Like, and so the getting away, like this kind of, if we eliminate Hong Kong as kind of the global financial services hub, that China will learn its lesson. I just don't see that working well at all. And if anything, many of the sanctions that the U.S. has already imposed are really going to cause, you know, damage to the working class in Hong Kong as much as anyone, right? What happens after that is really, really, really tough. And you can see the way that the pervasiveness of the national security law in really repressing all the common obvious ways in which Hong Kong activists and protesters can engage, all of that is severely impaired now. And so we really have to apply lessons, and you can already see people applying these lessons from people in the mainland, right? Also learning from the limitations. What does it look like to organize under, like, essentially this sort of authoritarian capitalist state, right? And what does it take to politically educate people, to organize from the grassroots level, to practice solidarity and mutual aid, and to build a robust base of folks who can stand the test of time and be your strong resistance base, even when individual things are cracked down upon? And that's not an easy question, right? There's nothing easy, but that's the question that will give you, that will set you, I think, activists and unionists on the right track to think about tactics after national security law, right? And what it may go into, it's too hard to say, because Hong Kong, I think, I don't know who said it, maybe it was Wilfred, or maybe it was one of the many other, you know, kind of smart Hong Kong observers. It was never built to resist Beijing. It's a city of like 7.4 million people. You can't do very much if the 1.4 billion folks, or rather the institution that governs the 1.4 billion folks, you know, says something that you don't want to do. And so we need allies. We need to, as a matter of political necessity, Hong Kong needs allies. what has it has done primarily in 2019 and 2020 is look to allies in what it folks perceive to be ideologically supportive states and the politicians of those states, right? And to its credit, it's been largely successful in doing this. It's really turned kind of the international state view of what was going on in Hong Kong negatively against Beijing and Carrie Lam's government. But it's now reached the end of the strategy, right? So you've got the appeals to these Western states. Beijing has paid in full the price of cracking down on Hong Kong. So now you have all of these sanctions, you have different ways of emigrating that are being negotiated with various Western states.
If they're good at capital, right? As Yang Cheng points out.
Yes, and it doesn't change the oppressions that the folks, the working class folks in Hong Kong have to deal with on a day-to-day basis. They could have the worst of both worlds, right? They have the authoritarian police state, and they have this most brutal kind of neoliberalist inequity where you have the highest Gini coefficient, income inequality in all the developed world. You have the highest property prices in all of the developed world. What is it going to do for the people that, the mass majority of people who cannot emigrate, right? So we don't know. We don't know. But people are struggling, and we know they will continue to struggle. They'll continue to read. They'll continue to learn. And, you know, everybody will have critiques, I think, of what's going on. But in my view, that comes from a place, especially for Hong Kongers, it comes from a place of love. It comes from a place of love for their homeland, right? Like for their home city. And it comes from a place of yearning for, something better. And I think when we're able to communicate that to, and that feeling as much as the politics, to different civil society formations, different political movements, different kind of groups fighting for their own autonomy, struggle, avoidance of genocide, there is a lot that we can do, and that we can do more. And so I'm as sad as I am about what has happened and what will likely happen in the short term, I am also really optimistic about the doors that can be opened if we're willing to put in the work and build the relationships with other sort of like emancipatory movements in the world.